from the family for years. She finds Tilly drinking herself to death in a trailer in the middle of the Nevada desert. The plot wasn't my life exactly, but a hypothetical version of my life that I hadn't lived. Tilly was loosely based on Phyllis, which is to say I wrote to fill the blank space of what I didn't know about Phyllis. But writing from Tilly's perspective gave me the chance to articulate an alcoholic's obsession without fully claiming it as my own. Tilly was pointedly not me. While I stole cheap Chardonnay from my job and drank it on a futon, Tilly stole cheap booze from her catering gigs and drank it in a closet, a ghost of the college closet where I'd stepped on a scale every morning. But I described her swollen face by looking in the mirror at my own, hungover in the morning, puffy, slack-jawed, glassy-eyed. I was careful to put up some fences between us. I made Tilly like gin most, because I preferred vodka. She binged in a dark closet full of rotten food and empty bottles, and I drank white wine, got rid of my empties every day, and showed up promptly, with clenched knuckles and determination, for tutoring gigs where I let my teenage clients flirt with me just a little bit while I coached them on the crude logic of analogy. Bandage is to blood as cast is to injury, or Pinot Grigio is to loneliness, or fiction is to diary. I purposefully sketched Tilly's life as more extreme than my own, a type of situational ventriloquism, throwing my own voice across distances. But I gave her all the parts of myself that were just coming into focus. Not just my bone-deep desire to get drunk every night, but my growing sense of drinking as the most important part of my life. My central relief, as well as a clarified vision of how I wanted the drinking to happen. Alone, without rules or witnesses, without shame. Though of course there was shame. There had been many kinds of shame. Tensing up whenever my manager took inventory in the pantry at the inn, worried that she would get suspicious at how many bottles of wine we'd gone through, or reaching for a stick of gum whenever guests returned, so they wouldn't smell the Chardonnay on my breath. Every Friday, when people put out their recycling bins on the street for pickup, I dropped a plastic shopping bag full of my own empties into a stranger's bin. Each time, it was like I'd gotten away with something. They couldn't be traced back to me. As Charles Jackson told countless AA meetings, writing a book about drinking didn't keep him from doing it. He had been sober for 8 years by the time The Lost Weekend was published in 1944, but he relapsed 3 years later. His stints of sobriety, sometimes grudging, sometimes passionately committed, always fraught, punctuated the ongoing catalog of wreckage that his life became. A slew of benders and hospitalizations, a growing tally of alienated friends and unpaid debts. His wife had to sell a mink coat to pay the coal bill. He spent decades smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day on one post-tubercular lung. His suicide attempts were so frequent they became, if not casual, at least horribly familiar. But from certain angles, in the dim lighting of certain midtown bars, Jackson's drinking carried the gloss and polish of legend. His archives include a bar tab 4 pages long. A fellow patient at the sanitarium where he went for his tuberculosis remembers waking one morning to find Jackson's footprint outlined in a dried puddle of wine. Jackson first stopped drinking at the age of 33, using something called the Peabody method. It was an approach grounded in pragmatism rather than psychoanalytic excavation, spirituality, or fellowship. It stressed honesty and reparations. Jackson worked with an unlicensed therapist named Bud Wister on rigorous daily schedules of self-improvement. We regulate our lives in orderly and profitable fashion without benefit of Freud, Jackson wrote in one progress report. I have lately acquired a sound responsibility based on sobriety and my true self. But The Lost Weekend offers another true self in its pages, or asks us to recognize that any self is always plural. You can sense a sober Jackson drinking vicariously through his protagonist. Don drinks whiskey in an uptown bar and a downtown bar, then settles into his favorite drinking pose of faux sophistication, curled up in a leather chair with a full tumbler and some classical music. During the years I spent writing this book, about my own drinking from the vantage point of 4 years sober, then 5 years sober, then 6 years sober, I sometimes sank into the old memories as if they were a comfortable couch, collapsing under the old spell of eerie, muted longing. It wasn't just predictable flavors of nostalgia, the sepia-toned glow of the Advocate's wooden floor, sticky with gin, but more surprising ones. Those restless early morning hangovers, parched and sour mouth, dog tired but unable to sleep. Even that discomfort had started to carry its own shabby glow. The Lost Weekend regards even drunken embarrassment with an oddly tender nostalgia. Jackson makes Don drunk dial F. Scott Fitzgerald, as Jackson himself once did, to tell him how much he loves his work, only to be politely rebuffed. Why don't you write me a letter about it? I think you're a little tight now. Making his protagonist call Fitzgerald in the middle of the novel was a poignant confession of Jackson's own literary aspirations and insecurities. He wanted to include himself in the ranks of the great drunk writers, but he didn't know if his own portrait of alcoholism, untethered from tragic meaning, was good enough to join the canon. When Don imagines the novel he will write, he conjures a winding yarn full of events punctuated by alcohol, the long affair with Anna, the drinking. But eventually the plot is overwhelmed by booze, even in hypothetical outline, until even the commas between binges disappear. The books begun and dropped, the unfinished short stories, the drinking, the drinking, the drinking. Jackson was actually doing something revolutionary in refusing to make his character's drinking a symbol of psychic complexity, by letting Don dismiss the question, "Why do you drink?" as irrelevant. It had long since ceased to matter why. You were a drunk. That's all there was to it. You drank, period. Don doesn't want to falsify the story of his drinking by ennobling it with overblown causes, though he's also worried about the story that remains without them. It wasn't even decently dramatic. It was nothing. Except it must have been something, because hundreds of thousands of readers were engrossed by a book that kept telling them they should probably put it down. The Lost Weekend is enthralling in an aggressive sense of thrall, a state of servitude or submission. Against my better instincts, I found myself rooting for Don to get his hands on the booze. I appreciated the frustrating force of his desire and wanted him to stop serving it. But I also wanted to see it satisfied. We love our drunk heroes intoxicated. We don't want to watch them get sober. When critic Lewis Hyde wrote about the Dream Songs 3 years after Berryman's death, he railed against the ways people had romanticized Berryman's drinking. "I am not saying that the critics could have cured Berryman of his disease," Hyde wrote, "but we could have provided a less sickening atmosphere." Hyde hated the vision of Berryman conjured by his whiskey and ink profile in life. The drunken poet as icon, holding court in Dublin pubs. Hyde resented the people who had seen Berryman's body as a symbol, with his wind-blown beard and a cigarette between his fingertips, his liquor as proof of his wisdom, rather than the sick, glugging heart of his disease. For his part, Berryman loved the life profile. It showed him a side of himself he wanted to believe in, a prophet surveying his kingdom of empty shot glasses, and fed the delusions that were feeding his drinking. The why-less drinking that Charles Jackson had proposed in The Lost Weekend would have been harder to absorb. That type of buffoonish drinking, with its vaguely comic desperation, didn't strike the same appealing pose as the poet with his quivering psychic antennae pointed toward death. Hyde's essay on Berryman is a fascinating artifact of anger. It's an attack on the dream songs waged in Berryman's own name. "It is my thesis here," Hyde argues, "that a war between alcohol and Berryman's creative powers is at the root of the dream songs." Hyde resists the ways these poems can be interpreted under the fancy handle of the epistemology of loss, insisting that they were really just sung by an alcoholic poet on his pity pot. If the poems stage a war between booze and creativity, Hyde insists, it's the booze that wins. We can hear the booze talking. Its tone is a moan that doesn't revolve. Its themes are unjust pain, resentment, self-pity, pride, and a desperate desire to run the world. It has the con man style and the con games plot. Hyde wasn't blaming Berryman for his disease, but he was angry at the sheen Berryman's sickness had acquired, and angry because he wished Berryman could have gotten better. He wanted a different ending to the story. Not Berryman jumping off the Washington Avenue bridge in a bitter Minnesota winter, but Berryman living one day at a time into the future. It would not have been easy, Hyde speculates. He would have had to leave behind a lot of his own work. He would have had to leave his friends who had helped him live off his pain for 20 years. When I first read Hyde on Berryman, a few years into my own sobriety, I whispered a secret, amen. I wanted to believe that giving up booze didn't mean giving up electricity, and Hyde was suggesting that the fruits of alcoholic composition weren't glorious but deeply compromised. Here was someone saying fuck off to a mythology that I'd come to see as corrosive and misguided. I loved Hyde for pushing back against the toxic filters that turned addiction into romance, and I loved him for articulating a version of the anger I carried toward a prior version of myself, consumed by self-pity that had come to seem grossly self-indulgent. It would be easy to dismiss Hyde's piece as shrill or puritanical, the rambling ad hominem attacks of a teetotaler stick in the mud, like a girl pacing around a swimming pool, as I once did, shrill-voiced, telling everyone to get out of the jacuzzi because it just wasn't safe to be there stoned. I was stoned too. But that's what I loved about Hyde's essay, its unfashionable indignation, its insistence on the horrors of drinking, rubbed bare of their gloss, and its conviction that these horrors weren't the engine of creativity, but its straitjacket. Where had all Hyde's anger come from, anyway? At the start of the essay, he confesses that for 2 years he worked as an orderly in a detox ward. He spent time in the trenches. That's part of why he needed to acknowledge that behind the photograph of the poet with his whiskey, there had been an actual man. Berryman's mythology offered its own supernatural alchemy. Whiskey was the fluid he ingested, and ink was the fluid he produced. Both were alternatives to ordinary human blood. But Berryman was full of ordinary human blood. Blood that his drinking slowly poisoned, and his life was full of fluids that weren't ink. The sweat of tremors and withdrawal, the vomit of illness, the piss and shit on his pants. Behind the mantra of whiskey and ink, those lyric parallels, there was a man with bruised shins living half his life in blackouts. His liver was so swollen with toxins it was palpable through his skin. This wasn't drinking as swagger or farce. This was drinking as seepage toward death. Billie Holiday was an addict whose life staged the collision of two addict myths, the romantic notion of the tortured artist and the morality tale of the deviant junkie. She was worshipped as a gloriously self-destructive genius, but she was also persecuted as a criminal. As a black woman raised poor in Baltimore in the 1920s, dogged by the justice system's double standards all her life, she wasn't granted the same unfettered access to the same mythologies as windblown Berryman. From the beginning, however, Holiday's legend was similarly tied up in the gloss and heat of her hurt, as if the beauty of her singing rose off her pain like steam off boiling water. The writer Elizabeth Hardwick was enchanted by Holiday's luminous self-destruction, while Harry Anslinger, during the late 30s and early 40s, made Holiday one of his personal crusades. One of the federal narcotic agents assigned to her case called her a very attractive customer because he knew it would be great publicity for the Federal Bureau of Narcotics if they could bring her down. When Holiday started shooting heroin in her mid-20s, it gave her back a stronger sense of herself. "I got a habit and I know it's no good," she wrote. "But it's the one thing that makes me know there's a person called Billie Holiday." A friend said she had a shyness so vast that she spoke in practically a whisper. But when she sang, her voice made her a legend in the jazz clubs of Manhattan. She was told nobody could sing the word hunger like she sang it. She sang the clubs on West 52nd, tucked into brownstone basements, and loved Jimmy's Chicken Shack, where the whiskey was served in teacups. Holiday gave gin to her chihuahuas, Chiquita and Pepe, and it was rumored she shot up her little boxer, Mister. Hardwick marveled at the sheer enormity of her vices, admiring the powerful alchemy by which Holiday was able to transform them into her extraordinary art. It was as if Holiday had risen to the occasion of her own pain. "For the grand destruction one must be worthy," Hardwick wrote, in awe of Holiday's ruthless talent and the opulent devastation. For Harry Anslinger, the enormity of Holiday's vices offered another type of opportunity. Her self-destruction wasn't luminous but criminal, and her celebrity was a convenient hook upon which he could hang the racist scripts he'd already been writing for years to bolster his crusade against drugs. His vendetta wasn't just about constructing the addict villain, but constructing the black addict villain. Since at the same time he was hunting Holiday, he was busy telling Judy Garland that she should get over her heroin habit by taking longer vacations between movie shoots. Anslinger assigned several agents to Holiday's case during the late 1940s, and they busted her on multiple occasions, including the 1947 conviction that sent her to Alderson Federal Prison Camp in West Virginia for almost a year. At Alderson, Holiday got Christmas cards from more than 3,000 fans all over the world. When her whiskey cravings got bad enough, she made moonshine from potato peelings in the commissary. Jimmy Fletcher, one of the men Anslinger assigned to track Holiday, ended up becoming quite fond of her. They once danced together at a club, and another night he sat with her and Chiquita, talking for hours. Years later, he remembered their relationship with regret. "When you form some sort of friendship with anybody," he said, "it's not pleasant to get involved in criminal activities against that person." The first time Fletcher busted Holiday, in the spring of 1947, she was staying at the Braddock Hotel in Harlem. Fletcher pretended he was delivering a telegram. During her strip search, Holiday forced Fletcher to watch her pee, a way of demanding that he face the degrading, invasive nature of his work. Some 40 years after that bust, in July 1986, ABC News introduced the American public to Jane, an addict with a $500-a-day freebase habit, and her premature twins, who each weighed 2 pounds 3 ounces. In October 1988, NBC News introduced Tracy, Erosalia, and Stephanie. Erosalia was recovering on a hospital bed after giving birth to her premature baby. Stephanie had left her baby at the hospital and was headed for a crack house. Tracy smoked crack on national TV. As criminologist Drew Humphreys argues, the media effectively created the crack mother as a sensational character, almost exclusively targeting minority women, although the majority of pregnant addicts were white. Occasionally contrite, but frequently shameless, the crack mother was almost always black or Latina, and she was invariably a failure at the primal task of motherhood. The problem with media scripts about the crack mother wasn't that crack addiction wasn't devastating individuals and communities. It was. But that the public outrage around crack mothers effectively redirected public notions of addiction away from disease and back to vice. This indignation offered a convenient scapegoat for the deeper ills fueling addiction: urban poverty, trickle-down economics, systemic racism, and obscured the science itself. Dr. Ira Chasnoff, whose early reports on the effects of cocaine in utero had fueled the press frenzy, eventually pushed back against what he called the media's early rush to judgment, explaining that he had never seen a crack kid and doubted he ever would. The figure of the crack mother sharpened to a vindictive blade the notion of addiction as something you were guilty of, rather than something you suffered from. A crack mother wasn't just damaging herself, she was damaging another body inside her own. "If you give drugs to your child because you can't help it," said Jeffrey Dean, one of the prosecutors who eventually put a crack mom on trial, "that's child abuse." Dean's phrasing held a contradiction he couldn't acknowledge. "You can't help it," suggested illness, but child abuse was a crime. It wasn't just that crack mothers were portrayed as irresponsible. It was that they appeared to have the wrong feelings about motherhood. Instead of showing shame, Tracy was defiant in the face of obvious censure, Humphreys writes. Instead of revealing remorse, Stephanie was indifferent to the baby she had left in the hospital. As opposed to those male geniuses whose addictions were understood as badges of psychic complexity or inner anguish, these women were portrayed as emotionally stunted or deformed by their addictions, or else guilty of some latent emotional deficiency that their addictions had exposed. And when white pregnant drug addicts were covered in the media, rarely, they were usually powder cocaine users depicted in states of contrition and recovery, and were often shown bathing or otherwise caring for their babies. But minority crack mothers fit neatly into pre-existing racist stereotypes. Now they weren't just part of the undeserving poor, welfare junkies who were corroding the civic body. They were actively destroying their own children. Crack mothers weren't just criticized for their addictions, they were prosecuted for them. Unlike most addicts, they entered the criminal justice system through the hospital, where doctors were asked to start turning over their pregnant patients to the legal system. Prosecutors twisted familiar laws in new ways. They sought an indictment for Melanie Green on manslaughter charges after her infant daughter, Bianca, died during the first week of her life. Jennifer Johnson was convicted of delivering a controlled substance to her unborn child. In Johnson's case, the prosecution claimed that Johnson had effectively been trafficking cocaine to her newborn, rewriting the umbilical cord as a state highway and their shared blood as a drug deal. Maybe sending a woman to jail is like killing a fly with a shotgun, said one judge. But I had other concerns. I had concerns about an unborn, helpless child-to-be. The crack mother was the negative image of the addict genius. She wasn't someone whose dependence fueled her creative powers. She was someone whose dependence meant she'd failed to create the way she was supposed to. When Billie Holiday told her own story in Lady Sings the Blues, her 1956 autobiography, she wasn't interested in peddling either of the addict myths that had been projected onto her, luminous self-destroyer or depraved villain. She was mainly interested in telling people heroin wouldn't do them any favors. If you think dope is for kicks and for thrills, you're out of your mind, she wrote. There are more kicks to be had in a good case of paralytic polio or by living in an iron lung. Holiday's co-author, journalist William Dufty, thought addiction would be a good gimmick to help them sell the memoir to publishers. But its account of addiction was actually remarkably unsensational, more concerned with tiring logistics than luminescence. I've been on and I've been off, Holiday explains. I've spent a small fortune on this stuff. She was less interested in waxing lyrical about her own pain than in honoring the maddening back and forth of addiction, its reversals and regressions, its tedium and stubborn siren call. With every relapse, she called herself No Guts Holiday. Rather than presenting her addiction as proof of psychic depth, she wanted to confess the ways others had suffered because of it. A habit is no damn private hell. And she was clear on one point. Dope never helped anybody sing better or play music better or do anything better. Take it from Lady Day. She took enough of it to know. It wasn't just a moralizing persona constructed for the pages of her book. To her pianist, Carl, she once said, "Don't you ever use this shit. It's no good for you. Stay away from it. You don't want to end up like me." Holiday genuinely wanted to stop using. Plenty of oral histories attest to that. But she had nothing but disdain for a system in which the cure was little more than a cloak for punishment. "I want you to know you stand convicted as a wrongdoer," one judge told her. But Holiday wanted to know, would he treat a diabetic like a criminal? Holiday had been treated like a criminal for as long as she could remember. She was born just a month after the Harrison Act came into effect in 1915, targeting the use and sale of opium and cocaine. and it was as if she'd been fated to a life bound up in its ongoing legacy. For a citizen like her, poor and black, the law was more likely to punish than protect. When she was almost raped at 10, she was treated as a criminal, arrested for solicitation, and then sent away to a disciplinary school. When she spurned a customer as a teenage call girl, she got treated as a criminal, sent away to jail for prostitution. When she got sick as an addict, she was treated as a criminal, sent away to Alderson. In Lady Sings the Blues, Holiday wrote that she wanted her country to wake up to its narcotics problem. For the sake of young kids whose whole life will be ruined because they are sent to jail instead of a hospital. But this plea was made in 1956, the same year Congress passed the Narcotic Control Act, mandating more drastic minimum sentencing. In the face of increasingly harsh drug legislation in the 1950s, another figure started to gain a cultish appeal, the unrepentant addict. William Burroughs' Junkie, subtitled Confessions of an Unredeemed Drug Addict, was published in 1953, the same year as Anslinger's Traffic in Narcotics. The cover was pure pulp, a man in wild disarray, necktie flailing, restraining a blonde vixen as she reaches for her dope works. Though, in truth, Burroughs' Junkie didn't try to keep anyone away from her dope. The novel's anti-hero isn't interested in going along with the establishment's redemption narratives. Given cooperation, the narrator knows, his doctor was ready to take down my psyche and reassemble it in 8 days. But he doesn't want to play along. Elizabeth Hardwick's vision of Holiday as an addict with no pleading need to quit, to modify, was another version of this figure. With cold anger, Hardwick wrote, Holiday spoke of various cures that had been forced upon her. The allure of the unrepentant addict has endured. When Amy Winehouse's single, Rehab, became a hit in 2007, half a century after Holiday published Lady Sings the Blues, it tapped into our running obsession. They tried to make me go to rehab. I said, no, no, no. It's a great song, straight up and flat out, jaunty and sublime. With Winehouse's singular voice all acrobatic and vaulting and rich, like vinyl and leather, chorus blunt and surprising, full of defiance where you might expect to find the keening croon of self-pity. Refusing rehab becomes its own statement of power. When I come back, you'll know, know, know. N-O turns into K-N-O-W. Resistance becomes knowledge. This isn't just refusal, it's a declaration of presence. And the success of Rehab as an anti-rehab anthem was attached to the appeal of Winehouse as an unrehabilitated woman. At one concert on the Isle of Wight, drunk and slurring her words, she ended Rehab by throwing a plastic cup full of wine. An arc of crimson sprayed across the stage. No, 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 she sang. She wouldn't go to rehab. She was doing this instead. The online clips of Winehouse's concerts, especially the ones that show her visibly intoxicated or tweaking on stage, have thousands of comments. People offer judgment. So many people dream of being a singer and being on stage, and Amy just threw it all away. Or else self-congratulatory sympathy. I see someone with a broken heart. After her final concert in Belgrade, which she spent muttering senselessly into the mic, one newscaster wondered, why do they keep putting her on stage? Surely they know she has a problem. Another said, this was supposed to be a comeback and she totally blew it. Something about her addiction made people angry. But their anger wasn't simple. The woman who wrote, Amy just threw it all away, had a story of her own. As for accidentally ODing, that's bullshit. My dad didn't have a fucking accident when he overdosed on heroin. Me and my brothers just stood and watched as the paramedics revived him. Someone else asked, does she want to go back to rehab now? It was a fantasy that Winehouse never tried to get clean. She went to rehab 4 times. Just as it was a fantasy that Holiday had no need to quit or modify. as if the only alternative to a woman completely victimized by her addiction was a woman who had no desire to live past it. Though Holiday spoke with cold anger about the cures that had been forced upon her, as Hardwick put it, it was more that Holiday was angry about the forcing and the punishments disguised as cures, rather than the idea of a cure itself. The unrepentant addict pushes back, in thrilling, necessary ways, against rabid, moralizing rhetoric and the kinds of social control that often masquerade as rehabilitation. Her open-ended story is an appealing antidote to the bow-tied conversion narrative. But fetishizing the unrepentant addict can also ignore her genuine desire to get well. It might have been appealing for Hardwick to imagine Holiday as a woman facing the wreckage of her life with unrepentant grandeur, but it's no accident that a white woman called Holiday's self-destruction luminous, while Holiday didn't see it that way at all. She was too aware of the price. After my grandmother died, I spent 5 months working two jobs, tutoring and innkeeping, to save the money I needed for an airplane ticket to Nicaragua and a month's rent once I got there, a room with a single bed in a small yellow house. I craved luminosity, the glimmering constellation points of a life told as anecdotes, and a world removed from the home where my grandmother had died. In a city called Granada, I volunteered at a two-room schoolhouse during the day, pretending to bite off my own fingers to teach second graders subtraction, and drank at night, more recklessly and more dramatically than I ever had before. This drinking looked more exotic than it had at my grandmother's house, when it had been about lukewarm wine bottles on a bare futon mattress, but it was still daily and necessary, still the relief I woke up craving. My first diary entry from Nicaragua began, no thoughts, just things. Piles of burning trash along the road from Managua, salsa music wailing from a stereo perched in front of a miniature bouncy castle, tiny pancakes bubbling on hot griddles outside the church, the mohawk spine of fur along a dog's back. I made sandwiches on shriveled bread with mashed avocados from the market, and shook big flakes of salt into my cupped palm to sprinkle on top of campesino cheese purchased from clattering carts. I used a liter soda bottle with the top cut away to pour water for my laundry. I never killed the cockroaches in my room because someone had told me that if you crushed a pregnant cockroach, all the eggs inside her belly would hatch. I was sure the stray dogs could smell my period when it came. In Granada, I was part of an ongoing ecosystem of tourists and parachute do-gooders and locals. Whenever a man stole a purse from one of the cantinas on Calle Calzada, a small flock of expats exploded after him, their flip-flops scattering to the side of the road, and then another man carefully collected these flip-flops and lined them up again, hoping for a tip, checking our discarded Tonya bottles to see if any had a few drops of beer left. I fell in with a crew of Dutch girls who were older and more cosmopolitan than I was. My Spanish was better than theirs, but it was my second language and their fourth. We passed an afternoon in hammocks by the Laguna de Apoyo, with cold beers and a warm breeze, eating whole fish roasted over flames, swimming in a volcanic basin with ribbons of chilly water and hot water swirled together like scarves. After a day in the ragged sunlight, I dreamed about fever, and then a few nights later I got one. I could feel it stroking my bones. I turned 24 by candlelight and woke up with the sour taste of last night's sangria in my mouth, my clothes smelling like smoke. Every afternoon I drank Tonyas with the Dutch girls, and every night we drank rum. I wasn't a huge rum fan, but it was all you could get in Nicaragua, so I drank it. Flor de Caña, the local favorite, or Nica Libres, which were just rum and cokes, like Cuba Libres, as if the revolution had been a little sibling formed in its elder's image. Those were the early days of Ortega's second lease on the dream, and it went black for hours at a time each night. The government was figuring out how to make electricity a public industry. When la luz se fue, the light left, we watched flame jugglers outside the cathedral. Boys pushed their baskets of cashews into our elbows. A caustic man from Quebec wondered what they did with all the fallen mangoes every morning. The warm darkness fell over my buzz like a blanket fort at dusk. We bought tamales from the woman at the corner of the Parque Central and ate them somewhere with candles or without candles, just fumbling with our hands. And some nights, we piled into unmarked black taxis and rode down the lake to Oscar's, where people danced and snorted lines of coke, where little black flies lifted in a fluttering scrim over the water at dawn. There was a traveling magician on crutches who came around most nights. He was missing one leg from the knee down. He was clearly a drunk. I remember thinking, you should take better care of yourself. At the school where I volunteered, I ran an Uno game during recess. I learned how the kids played. Leticia was merciless and impatient with anyone who wasn't. One Gloria played fast. The other Gloria played slow enough to give the others a chance to plead their cases about which color she should choose. Amarillo, rojo, verde. She liked the power. My students colored between the lines on their paper payasitos, little paper clowns. From the woman who stood beside the rusted metal swings, they bought plantain chips and something that looked like toothpaste made of sugar. After I saw lice crawling through Sol's hair, I went to the dim concrete box of our local farmacia, where I mimed the bugs crawling across my scalp to make sure I got the right little brown bottle of poison. For the first time in my life, I started getting real hangovers, a sour mouth and twin heartbeats of pain in my temples, a head stuffed with crumpled up pieces of paper like a trash can, all of them rasping against each other whenever I nodded. Nursing a hangover. You have to care for the aftermath like a child you've given birth to. I started drinking with a guy named Felipe from Managua, and whenever we got drunk, he talked about being alcoholic. The way he put it, being alcoholic wasn't anything that made him special. It was just true for him and for a lot of the guys he'd grown up with. He wasn't packing up his drinking and taking it on an international flight or to his job at a Santa Monica inn. He wasn't busy blaming his frequent flyer father. He didn't feel particularly sorry for himself. This was just a way of being, and it wasn't his alone. Felipe and I got blind drunk and went dancing at Oscar's by the lake, kissed as dawn brightened the sky. A mist of flies rose off the greenish water and fluttered around us in the early light. Felipe told me things in Spanish that it would have embarrassed me to hear in English. Quiero tu boca. ¿Quieres mi boca? I started to translate. I want your mouth. Do you want my mouth? Until I forced myself to let go, to stop translating, to lean into his body and into the drunkenness itself. My drinking was still winding its tentacles into everything, as it had in Los Angeles and Iowa before that. But now it was happening on a different stage set, with dark cobblestone streets and mangoes 6 for $1, with unreliable electricity and candlelight that wavered like a voice about to break into crying. There was more narrative action in this play than there had been when I drank on a futon in front of movies on my laptop. But the central themes were the same. Wanting it, getting it, wanting it again. One night I was walking from one bar to another, drunk on a quiet street, and got punched by a stranger who took my purse after breaking my nose. The blood splattered all over my skirt. There was a night with a stranger named Mackie. I can't remember if that was his last name or just a nickname. My memory is a pile of scraps, sodden and souring. I remember riding in an unmarked black cab, my knees against other knees, voices filling the small car, jostling over rutted roads, with the jutting rebar of unfinished second stories profiled against the night, barbed fences and trash piles catching stray vectors of streetlight. I remember sitting on his lap in a huge group of strangers and feeling him push his fingers into me and not wanting them there, but being too drunk to tell him to stop, and too embarrassed somehow, as if my drunkenness had invited them. I don't remember asking him to come back to my room, though I do remember him taking off my clothes in an open courtyard outside my bedroom and realizing that the night guard was standing nearby in the shadows, not because he wanted to be there, but because it was his job. At a certain point, we were on my bed and I didn't want to fuck him, but I was too drunk and too tired to figure out how not to fuck him. So I just lay there, still and quiet, while he finished. The situation would sharpen into awareness in fleeting moments, and I'd think, this isn't what I want. And then it would dissolve into soft focus again. I remember lying there afterward, going in and out of sleep, not wanting to sleep with him there next to me, not knowing what he'd do, but deeply tired, flattened and confused by where the drunkenness had taken me, with the terrible insect whirring of my fan going on and off as the power cut out and came back. I remember cool air prickling the sweat on my back. Then he tried to turn me over and fuck me again, and I rolled away and fell asleep. And then he woke me up and turned me over again, and then I pushed him away again, and then he woke me up and turned me over, and then I pushed him away, and then I'd be lying if I told you I remembered how many times he rolled my drunk body over and tried to fuck it again. I can tell you that I just lay there for a while afterward with my mind swimming far away from my body, and I prayed for him to leave. I had fucked him because it was easier than not fucking him, because it seemed hypocritical to stop what we'd started, like I'd already promised him something just by letting him come back to my room, like I owed him something as payment for the meager gift he'd given me, the affirmation of wanting to fuck me in the first place. My rum blood believed every man's desire was a gift he gave to me and a promise I made to him. But there was also this, beyond and beneath each because. It happened because I was drunk and because he didn't stop. The next day, the night guard told me no more visitors, and I thought of what we'd done in front of him, how rude and blind it had been. I went to school. I taught subtraction. I played Uno. My hangover pounded at my skull like it wanted out. The heat was impossibly thick. I stood in a dry gully behind the classrooms and felt sick, chugged orange Fanta and felt sicker. I apologized to one of my Dutch friends for getting so drunk the night before, and she shrugged. Not in a bad way, more in a your life, not mine way. I was apologizing to her because it seemed like something had happened that required an apology, and maybe I could get it out of me by apologizing to someone, anyone, enough. 4. Lack. During my dry mouth mornings in Nicaragua, hangover after hangover, I touched something in myself that wasn't right, something unguarded and sweat-stained and sloppy. So when I moved back to the States that fall to start a doctoral program at Yale, I decided to drink differently. No more beer, no more rum, only clear liquor, which seemed purer when I imagined it traveling through me, and white wine. A lot of it. I lied to the guy at the wine shop on Orange Street. I'm throwing a little dinner party. What's good with salmon? Knowing full well I was drinking alone that night. I might eat some crackers from the box. We'll be 8, I'd say. Do you think I should get 2 bottles or 3? Pretending the we of myself, cracker-crumbed and sour-breathed, was a moderate crowd. Pretending I wasn't used to these kinds of calculations. The nights I actually did have people over, I had to get even more. One of my first friends in New Haven was a graduate student named Dave, a charming, gregarious poet. When I had visited Yale as a prospective student, I'd stayed with him and his girlfriend in their apartment on Humphrey Street, a warm, lamp-glowing place with hardwood floors and endless bookshelves. Nothing like my bare room back in California, with its futon mattress and empty wine bottles tucked in a plastic bag in the closet. Dave's girlfriend was a few years older than us, almost 30, and their life seemed intoxicating in its domesticity and its adultness. Granola for breakfast, overdue library books, weekend hikes. Oddly enough, I realized I'd actually already met Dave almost 10 years before when we were seniors in high school on opposite sides of the country at a national arts program, a scholarship that had funded 20 high school students to attend a week of classes at a hotel in Miami. "I remember you," I told him. "You had a goatee. You played your guitar in the lobby." What I did not say, I'd watched him from the shadows, behind a potted plant, as he'd played to a group of people, all laughing and talking, before disappearing back into my hotel room, too shy to join them. "Of course," he said. "Amazing." He seemed delighted by the coincidence, though I was stunned he remembered me at all. Although the program had only 20 students, I was sure I'd been invisible. The week after I moved to New Haven, I invited Dave and his girlfriend over to my apartment for dinner. They were my first guests. I drank while I cooked, as usual, preparing the same risotto I'd made for my grandmother's memorial service, cooked with cheddar and Corona, her favorite beer. Slicing pears for a salad, I used my roommate's mandolin, with its fearsome horizontal blade, to shave layers of fruit so paper thin I could see their veins. After the third glass of wine, I sent my thumb over the blade. It was less like a cut and more like a section of my thumb had been removed. A sliver of flesh-colored fruit, salad possible. I texted Dave, "Can you bring a Band-Aid?" And then, "Actually, a couple." And then, "I promise I didn't bleed in your food." And then, thinking the whole series looked a little suspect, a final message that was just a string of exclamation points. In the meantime, I wrapped wads of toilet paper around my bleeding thumb and tightened the toilet paper wrapping with a hairband. It looked like a little ghost. Dave and his girlfriend arrived with Band-Aids and an olive oil cake. Who knew such a thing existed? I accepted their Band-Aids, but was afraid to unwrap my thumb because I didn't want it to start bleeding again. It had taken long enough to stop the first time. We sat at a round table under my living room skylight, crouching under my slanted attic roof, and I held the stem of my wine glass with four fingers and one puffy white pillow. It stayed numb all through dinner. New Haven was a grayish, contradictory city, full of massive brick housing projects and side streets full of quaint Victorian cottages, Gothic dorms and imposing concrete buildings built in the style called brutalist, with windowless flanks like faces without eyes. You could sense the invisible borders where vegetarian cafes and scruffy secondhand bookstores gave way to dollar shops and methadone clinics, where the botanical garden edged onto an abandoned rifle factory. After getting my nose broken, I was afraid to walk alone at night, though I was also ashamed of my nervousness. That fall, I fell immediately, greedily, into a consuming relationship with a man named Peter, another graduate student. In the same way that drinking white wine in an attic apartment seemed safely distanced from stumbling rum-drunk through dark Nicaraguan alleys, getting involved with a whip-smart Henry James acolyte seemed safely removed from letting strangers fuck me on sweaty sheets. Peter and I spent our mornings at a local coffee shop, describing our dreams and splitting muffins the size of softballs. Then we parted ways so we could spend the rest of the day writing each other emails about the parts of our dreams we'd forgotten to describe earlier. Sometimes I'd delay reading his message just to keep its unread potential like a warm glow in my gut, not unlike the glow of imagining the first drink. Knowing when I would see Peter again was in fact the same thing as knowing when I would drink again. Always that night, because we always drank when we were together. We bought cheap Magnum bottles of Shiraz and fixed plates of cheese and crackers and often never even cooked dinner. Falling in love was the only sensation that had ever truly rivaled drinking. For buzz and transportation, sheer immersive force. And with Peter, they came conveniently entwined. Peter was tall and reserved, but his observations were full of caustic, witty judgment. His eyes were blue and crystalline, adamant, their beauty piercing and skeptical. It felt like victory to be admired by him. He was one of the most intelligent people I'd ever met. His mind was precise and relentless, his phrases like scrimshaw, whittled to intricate perfection. His ability and willingness and actual compulsion to dissect himself at all moments were the only instances of self-consciousness I'd ever encountered that struck me as more obsessive than my own. We were like two 24-hour archaeological digs happening side by side. Just when you thought we'd pause for lunch, we went deeper. It was no wonder we got drunk so much. We just wanted a fucking break. Booze let me live inside moments without the endless chatter of my own self-conscious annotation. It was like finally going on vacation somewhere beautiful without having to pose for photographs the whole time. Magnums helped us get simple and sloppy. Self-awareness burned off like fog, and there we were, watching America's Next Top Model on his IKEA bed or my IKEA bed, and speculating about the possibly anorexic identical twins. Who would get kicked off first? How would the other cope? The depth and intensity of our relationship provided the perfect alibi for drinking. Peter certainly wasn't fucking my drunk, senseless body when I didn't want him to. He was figuring out his dissertation and bringing me baked goods, rum cake and peanut butter chocolate chip cookies. For a year, we basically drank and ate dessert. Sometimes we met at an Irish bar on State Street, with baskets of peanuts on the tables, broken shells all over the floor, and drank vodka tonics till we stumbled home through the sharp autumn cold. I started getting there early enough to drink one vodka before Peter arrived, then early enough to drink two, and then three. And then, once Peter came, we always had so much to talk about. Every thought I'd ever had about Victorian illness memoirs, or the stuffed tiger my dad had given me as a kid, or the etymology of the word render. I was never out of class, always trying to impress. There was no amount of myself I could give Peter that seemed like too much. He wanted every observation, every impulse. After several years of men who'd wanted a night or a month, this was like a homecoming. I wanted to deposit myself inside him, like putting myself in a vault for safekeeping. We wrote enough letters to sustain a long-distance relationship, but we lived only three blocks apart. It was hard to imagine we were trying to escape anything, much less each other. But in truth, I was escaping something subtler. The possibility of any distance, any fissure, any silence, any seam. We talked about everything, including how maybe we drank too much. So we decided we wouldn't drink on Mondays. I grew to dread Mondays. Then it wasn't every Monday. That was better. Then it was forgotten entirely. All my life I had believed, at first unconsciously, then explicitly, that I had to earn affection and love by being interesting. And so I had frantically tried to become really fucking interesting. Once I hit the right relationship, I planned to hurl my interestingness at it, like a final exam I'd spent my whole life studying for. This was it. The theorist Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick argues that addiction isn't about the substance so much as the surplus of mystical properties the addict projects onto it. Granting the substance the ability to provide consolation, repose, beauty, or energy, she writes, can operate only corrosively on the self, thus self-construed as lack. The more you start to need a thing, whether it's a man or a bottle of wine, the more you are unwittingly, reflexively, implicitly convincing yourself you're not enough without it. For much of my 20s, I scribbled different versions of the same question in my diary. Always when I was drunk. Am I an alcoholic? Is this what it's like to be an alcoholic? My shame about drinking wasn't mainly about embarrassment at what I did when I was drunk. It was about how much I wanted to get drunk in the first place. Intoxication had become the feeling I was most interested in having. In Dream Song 14, Berryman's speaker remembers what his mother told him when he was young. Ever to confess you're bored means you have no inner resources. wanting to get drunk, at least as much as I wanted to get drunk, seemed like a similar confession. Years later, I interviewed a clinician who described addiction as a narrowing of repertoire. For me, that meant my whole life contracting around booze, not just the hours I spent drinking, but the hours I spent anticipating drinking, regretting drinking, apologizing for drinking, figuring out when and how to drink again. It's nothing new, the desire to disrupt consciousness, to soften it, blunt it, sharpen it, distort it, flood it with bliss, paper over its disenchantments. The desire to alter consciousness is as old as consciousness itself. It's another way to describe the act of living. We just keep discovering things we can put into our bodies to change ourselves more dramatically, more suddenly, to feel relief or euphoria or the dulling of anxiety, to feel different, to feel the world made strange, more spellbinding, or simply more possible. The temperance movement called liquor demon drink, a way to externalize the desires for escape, for weightlessness, for euphoria, for extremity that seek fluid or powder forms beyond our bodies. Addiction doesn't surprise me. It seems more surprising that some people aren't addicted to anything. From the night of my first buzz, I didn't understand why everyone in the world wasn't getting drunk every night. Addicts often describe every high as chasing the first one, the purest, the most revelatory, trying to recapture, as psychiatrist Adam Kaplan puts it, that first time going through the turnstile. Dr. Kaplan told me that one of his alcoholic patients, an artist, remembered his first cup of vodka as warmth filling his entire body, scalp to toes, the unmistakable feeling of coming home. Scientists describe addiction as a dysregulation of the neurotransmitter functions of the mesolimbic dopamine system, which basically means your reward pathways get fucked up. It's a pathological usurpation of survival impulses. The compulsion to use overrides normal survival behaviors like seeking food, shelter, and mating. It's the narrowing again. This. Only this. A chart from the early years of AA frames alcoholism as reckless bookkeeping. Factual gain and loss chart on uncontrolled drinking. It's composed of two columns presented side by side. Assets and liabilities. Every asset has its corresponding liability, which is to say, its price. The pleasure of disregarding conventions sits alongside the penalty of indiscretions, and the satisfying flight from reality produces the fear of being sober enough to see depleted self in true light. The liabilities column grows wider and wider near the bottom of the page, representing the progress of the disease, forcing the assets column to grow narrower and narrower. And the whole thing ends in capital letters and exclamation points. Wet brain, institutions, death. Neuropharmacologist George Koob, director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, would call this vertical disintegration a spiraling distress addiction cycle, comprising three interconnected stages. Preoccupation anticipation, binge intoxication, and withdrawal negative effect. In one popular science volume about addiction, the chart explaining the spiraling distress addiction cycle looks like a tornado with an arrow pointing straight down through the middle. In a nearby illustration of neurotransmitter activity, the neuron receptors look cheerful, just waiting to get activated. They have no idea what's ahead. It's a strange type of double vision to rewatch certain moments of my own life with the subtitles of biology playing underneath, like watching a thriller once the trick ending has been explained. I can understand sniffing lines of coke off a boy's coffee table as the activation of a receptor that blocked dopamine reuptake, so the dopamine stuck around longer in my synapses. But I felt that blocked dopamine reuptake as the surge of my own voice, It was the sloughing of a snakeskin, the shedding of fear. When I look back at a night with a stranger in Nicaragua, I can say the GABA receptors in my neurons were activated by the rum in my veins.